Jessica twisted her neck, spat out the gag. She pitched her voice in low, intimate tones.
Gentlemen, no need to fight over me.
At the same time, she writhed sinuously for Kennet's benefit. She saw them grow tense, knowing that in this instant they were convinced of the need to fight over her. Their disagreement required no other reason. In their minds, they were fighting over her. She held her face high in the instrument glow to be sure Kennet would read her lips, said,
"You mustn't disagree."
They drew farther apart, glanced warily at each other.
"Is any woman worth fighting over?"
she asked. By uttering the words, by being there, she made herself infinitely worth their fighting. Paul clamped his lips tightly closed, forced himself to be silent. There had been the one chance for him to succeed with the voice. Now, everything depended on his mother, whose experience went so far beyond his own.
"Yeah," Scarface said. "No need to fight over."
His hand flashed toward the pilot's neck. The blow was met by a splash of metal that caught the arm and in the same motion slammed into Kennet's chest. Scarface groaned, sagged backward against his door.
"Thought I was some dummy, didn't know that trick,"
Chigo said. He brought back his hand, revealing the knife. It glittered in reflected moonlight.
"Now for the cub," he said, and leaned toward Paul.
"No need for that,"
Jessica murmured. Chigo hesitated.
"Wouldn't you rather have me cooperative?"
Jessica asked.
"Give the boy a chance."
Her lip curled in a sneer.
"Little enough chance he'd have out there in that sand. Give him that, and..."
She smiled.
"You could find yourself well rewarded."
Chigo glanced left, right, returned his attention to Jessica.
"I've heard me what can happen to a man in this desert," he said. "Boy might find the knife a kindness."
"Is it so much, I ask?"
Jessica pleaded.
"You're trying to trick me," Chigo muttered.
"I don't want to see my son die," Jessica said. "Is that a trick?"
Chigo moved back, elbowed the door latch. He grabbed Paul, dragged him across the seat, pushed him half out the door, and held the knife posed.
"What'll you do, cub, if I cut your bonds?"
"He'll leave here immediately and head for those rocks," Jessica said.
"Is that what you'll do, cub?"
Chigo asked. Paul's voice was properly surly.
"Yes."
The knife moved down, slashed the bindings of his legs. Paul felt the hand on his back to hurl him down onto the sand, feigned a lurch against the doorframe for purchase, turned as though to catch himself, lashed out with his right foot. The toe was aimed with a precision that did credit to his long years of training, as though all of that training focused on this instant. Almost every muscle of his body cooperated in the placement of it. The tip struck the soft part of Chigo's abdomen just below the sternum, slammed upward with terrible force over the liver and through the diaphragm to crush the right ventricle of the man's heart. With one gurgling scream, the guard jerked backward across the seats. Paul, unable to use his hands, continued his tumble onto the sand, landing with a roll that took up the force and brought him back to his feet in one motion. He dove back into the cabin, found the knife, and held it in his teeth while his mother sawed her bonds. She took the blade and freed his hands.
"I could have handled him," she said. "He'd have had to cut my bindings. That was a foolish risk."
"I saw the opening and used it," he said.
She heard the harsh control in his voice, said,
"Yui's house sign is scrawled on the ceiling of this cabin."
He looked up, saw the curling symbol.
"Get out and let us study this craft," she said. "There's a bundle under the pilot's seat. I felt it when we got in."
"Bomb?"
"Doubt it. There's something peculiar here."
Paul leaped out to the sand and Jessica followed. She turned, reached under the seat for the strange bundle, seeing Chigo's feet close to her face, feeling dampness on the bundle as she removed it, realizing the dampness was the pilot's blood.
"Waste of moisture," she thought,
knowing that this was Arakeen thinking. Paul stared around them, saw the rock scarp lifting out of the desert like a beach rising from the sea, wind-carved palisades beyond. He turned back as his mother lifted the bundle from the thopter, saw her stare across the dunes toward the shield wall. He looked to see what drew her attention, saw another thopter swooping toward them, realized they'd not have time to clear the bodies out of this thopter and escape.
"Run, Paul!"
Jessica shouted.
"It's Harkonnen's!" Arrakis teaches the attitude of the knife, chopping off what's incomplete and saying, "Now it's complete because it's ended here."
From Collected Sayings of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan. A man in Harkonnen uniform skidded to a stop at the end of the hall, stared in at Yui, taking in at a single glance Mape's body, the sprawled form of the Duke,
Yui standing there. The man held a laser gun in his right hand. There was a casual air of brutality about him, a sense of toughness and poise that sent a shiver through Yui.
Sardaukar, Yui thought.
A Bashar, by the look of him. Probably one of the Emperor's own, sent here to keep an eye on things. No matter what the uniform, there's no disguising them.
You're Yui, the man said.
He looked speculatively at the Sook School ring on the doctor's hair, stared once at the diamond tattoo, and then met Yui's eyes.
I am Yui, the doctor said.
You can relax, Yui, the man said. When you dropped the house shields, we came right in. Everything's under control here. Is this the Duke?
This is the Duke.
Dead?
Merely unconscious. I suggest you tie him.
Did you do for these others?
He glanced back down the hall where Mapes's body lay.
More's the pity, Yui muttered.
Pity, the Sardaukar sneered.
He advanced, looked down at Leto.
So that's the great Red Duke.
If I had doubts about what this man is, that would end them, Yui thought. Only the Emperor calls the Atreides the Red Dukes.
The Sardaukar reached down, cut the Red Hawk insignia from Leto's uniform.
Little souvenir, he said. Where's the ducal signet ring?
He doesn't have it on him, Yui said.
I can see that, the Sardaukar snapped.
Yui stiffened, swallowed.
If they press me, bring in a truthsayer, they'll find out about the ring, about the thopter I prepared. All will fail. Sometimes the Duke sent the ring with a messenger as surety that an order came directly from him, Yui said.
Must be damned trusted messengers, the Sardaukar muttered.
Aren't you going to tie him? Yui ventured.
How long will he be unconscious?
2 hours or so. I wasn't as precise with his dosage as I was for the woman and boy.
The Sardaukar spurned the Duke with his toe.
This was nothing to fear, even when awake. When will the woman and boy awaken?
About 10 minutes.
So soon?
I was told the Baron would arrive immediately behind his men.
So he will. You'll wait outside, Yui.
He shot a hard glance at Yui.
Now!
Yui glanced at Leto.
What about—
He'll be delivered to the Baron all properly trussed like a roast for the oven.
Again, the Sardaukar looked at the diamond tattoo on Yui's forehead.
You're known. You'll be safe enough in the halls. We've no more time for chit-chat, traitor. I hear the others coming.
Traitor,
Yui thought. He lowered his gaze, pressed past the Sardaukar, knowing this as a foretaste of how history would remember him.
Yui the traitor.
He passed more bodies on his way to the front entrance and glanced at them, fearful that one might be Paul or Jessica. All were house troopers or wore Harkonnen uniform. Harkonnen guards came alert, staring at him as he emerged from the front entrance into flame-lighted night. The palms along the road had been fired to illuminate the house. Black smoke from the flammables used to ignite the trees poured upward through orange flames.
"It's the traitor," someone said.
"The Baron will want to see you soon," another said.
"I must get to the thopter," Yui thought. "I must put the ducal signet where Paul will find it."
And fear struck him.
"If Idaho suspects me or grows impatient, if he doesn't wait and go exactly where I told him, Jessica and Paul will not be saved from the carnage. I'll be denied even the smallest relief from my act."
The Harkonnen guard released his arm, said,
"Wait over there, out of the way."
Abruptly, Yui saw himself as cast away in this place of destruction, spared nothing, given not the smallest pity.
"Idaho must not fail!"
Another guard bumped into him, barked,
"Stay out of the way, you!"
"Even when they've profited by me, they despise me,"
Yui thought. He straightened himself as he was pushed aside, regained some of his dignity.
"Wait for the Baron!" a guard officer snarled.
Yui nodded, walked with controlled casualness along the front of the house, turned the corner into shadows out of sight of the burning palms. Quickly, every step betraying his anxiety, Yui made for the rear yard beneath the conservatory where the thopter waited, the craft they had placed there to carry away Paul and his mother. A guard stood at the open rear door of the house, his attention focused on the lighted hall and men banging through there, searching from room to room. How confident they were! Yui hugged the shadows, worked his way around the thopter, eased open the door on the side away from the guard. He felt under the front seats for the Fremkit he had hidden there, lifted a flap, and slipped in the ducal signet. He felt the crinkling of the spice paper there, the note he had written, pressed the ring into the paper. He removed his hand, resealed the pack. Softly, Yui closed the thopter door, working his way back to the corner of the house and around toward the flaming trees.
"Now it is done," he thought.
Once more, he emerged into the light of the blazing palms. He pulled his cloak around him, stared at the flames.
"Soon I will know. Soon I will see the Baron, and I will know. And the Baron, he will encounter a small tooth."
There is a legend that the instant the Duke Leto Atreides died, a meteor streaked across the skies above his ancestral palace on Caladan.
The Princess Irulan, Introduction to a Child's History of Muad'Dib. The Baron Vladimir Harkonnen stood at a viewport of the grounded lighter he was using as a command post. Out the port, he saw the flame-lighted knight of Arrakeen. His attention focused on the distant shield wall where his secret weapon was doing its work. Explosive artillery. The guns nibbled at the caves where the Duke's fighting men had retreated for a last-ditch stand. Slowly measured bites of orange glare, showers of rock and dust in the brief illumination, and the Duke's men were being sealed off to die by starvation, caught like animals in their burrows. The Baron could feel the distant chomping, a drumbeat carried to him through the ship's metal. Broomp, broomp. Then, broomp, broomp.
"Who would think of reviving artillery in this day of shields?"
The thought was a chuckle in his mind.
"But it was predictable that Duke's men would run for those caves, and the Emperor will appreciate my cleverness in preserving the lives of our mutual force."
He adjusted one of the little suspensors that guarded his fat body against the pull of gravity. A smile creased his mouth, pulled at the lines of his jowls.
"A pity to waste such fighting men as the Duke's," he thought.
He smiled more broadly, laughing at himself.
"Pity should be cruel."
He nodded. Failure was, by definition, expendable. The whole universe sat there, open to the man who could make the right decisions. The uncertain rabbits had to be exposed, made to run for their burrows. Else how could you control them and breed them? He pictured his fighting men as bees routing the rabbits, and he thought,
"The day hums sweetly when you have enough bees working for you."
A door opened behind him. The Baron studied the reflection in the night-blackened viewport before turning. Peiter de Vries advanced into the chamber, followed by Umminkudu, the captain of the Baron's personal guard. There was a motion of men just outside the door, the mutton faces of his guard, their expressions carefully sheep-like in his presence. The Baron turned. Peiter touched finger to forelock in his mocking salute.
"Good news, my lord! The Sardaukar have brought in the Duke!"
"Of course they have," the Baron rumbled.
He studied the somber mask of villainy on Piter's effeminate face, and the eyes, those shaded slits of bluest blue and blue.
"Soon I must remove him," the Baron thought. "He has almost outlasted his usefulness, almost reached the point of positive danger to my person. First, though, he must make the people of Arrakis hate him. Then they will welcome my darling Fade Rotha as a savior."
The Baron shifted his attention to the guard captain, Umminkudu. Scissors line of jaw muscles, chin like a boot toe, a man to be trusted because the captain's vices were known.
"First, where is the traitor who gave me the Duke?" the Baron asked. "I must give the traitor his reward."
Peiter turned on one toe, motioned to the guard outside. A bit of black movement there, and Yui walked through. His motions were stiff and stringy. The mustache drooped beside his purple lips. Only the old eyes seemed alive. Yui came to a stop 3 paces into the room, obeying a motion from Peiter, and stood there staring across the open space at the Baron.
"Ah, Dr. Yui."
"My lord Harkonnen."
"You've given us the Duke, I hear."
"My half of the bargain, my lord."
The Baron looked at Peiter. Peiter nodded. The Baron looked back at Yui.
"The letter of the bargain, eh? And I," he spat the words out, "what was I to do in return?"
"You remember quite well, my lord Harkonnen,"